I'm Stargate Pioneer from the official GunnaGeek.com podcast, a proud member of the GunnaGeek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Paul McGann, the Eighth Doctor. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus. I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Witten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive. Reactive. Proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry, if we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 220 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where it's a journey to the Earth's core, which we've learned from countless science fiction novels, films, and television stories, is the most enjoyable, happy-go-lucky endeavor a crew of good-natured scientists can embark on. What could make it even better? Why, military involvement, of course. Sing along, you know the words. I am Jay, and with me in the GPR studios this week, over in the corner sporting a new eye patch is Haley. How are you doing, Haley?
Arrgh.
And with a terrible wig over in the other corner is Keir. How are you doing, Keir?
Arr, 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 arr. I'm a werewolf.
So what are we doing this week, Haley?
Well, this week we all swap facial hair and a few of us even go full incendiary werewolf as we revel in one of the gems of the Pertwee era, Inferno. When a supreme jerk of a project leader ignores the fatal dangers on the side of his drilling expedition, the Doctor and Liz's efforts aren't even enough to stave him off. What's more, we find that a bad idea isn't even enough on one dimension. Why not screw up the existence of parallel universes while you're at it?
Sure.
Sounds like fun to me.
Yeah. We've been waiting for this one. We know a lot of our listeners have been waiting for this one because this is probably the... as Haley described it, it's not only the gem of the Pertwee era, in a lot of people's estimation, this is like the crown jewel, because it has everything that you love about the Pertwee era, and more so. You've got the action, you've got some very comedic elements, you've got great character interaction, you've got an interesting demand on the talent, because of a little duality that we'll get into in a moment. Plus, you've got a really, really solid storyline and pacing that stays throughout. Even though, as we've been sort of maligning these 7-part stories in recent weeks, this one feels good. I mean, just generally kind of well-plotted, well-figured, and well-paced. So...
Yeah.
Before we get to all the kind of listener reactions to this, Haley, I always shine the light on you first. How did you feel about working your way through 100 minutes of Inferno?
This one was not as much of a slog as some of the other 7-parters are. I think you still definitely could have tightened it up by an episode or two without losing much, but it wasn't as much of a burden to get through huge swaths of it.
Oh, how kind.
That is high praise.
It wasn't nearly as much suck as the previous sucks did suck.
I enjoyed this one.
Good. Jay, what about yourself? Had you ever seen Inferno before, Jay?
No, actually. This is one that I have missed.
Okay.
So, yeah, this was my first time through it as well. I've got to agree with Haley. I felt like there could have been some tightening.
Maybe that 4 minute scene of him pushing the button on the TARDIS and then his face spinning back and forth.
I don't know. That was groundbreaking special effects for the time.
But it seemed like it kind of went on forever.
Yes, but I will give it credit. They only waited about 10 minutes into the first episode before we had classic Pertwee mugging and making the googie face and everything. I mean, I was amazed that it lasted that long. What didn't last that long was the first mustache joke. That was like 2 minutes in to the first episode. And what's great is now that you know this, now that you've been all the way through, this is one of those stories where you can go back and you can watch it again in knowledge of everything that's going to happen. And you pick up on all of the bookend gags that they put in.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's when he comes out of the coma in the seventh episode and he makes the, you know, you really are much more enjoyable with the mustache thing that just pairs it up. Oh, come on. Really. And then you spend the entire rewatch wondering, all right, did they have fake mustaches and beards on, or did they shoot all the original stuff and then everybody shaved their faces and then they shot the new stuff?
Yeah. Great. Now that's all I'm going to be able to think about for the rest of this episode.
Yeah.
I can't imagine they shot these episodes out of order, because that doesn't seem like the production style back then.
True. But I don't know. I mean, there were a lot of things. Well, first of all, let me just kind of back up. I will say that as far as from a technical aspect, there are some things about the story that I absolutely love. I mean, and we'll get to some of the listener contributions that we had actually tee up a lot of the things that that I will give a lot of praise to the story for. But just in terms of the production itself, I will say that, you know, in terms of the set itself, like the commonly go-to set within the drill site operation control center, is actually one of their more solid, and I mean that in every literal term.
Yeah.
You know, oh, it's actual metal. Oh, okay, actual lights, actual glass, and so forth. You know,
and that's true, because it really did feel like somewhere that people were working instead of just, oh, this is, you know, this is the set we built for this week.
The console didn't wobble every time somebody hit a button. It was nice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. With the exception of the one nuclear reactor power switch that was really easy to slide up and down. But other than that, I mean, everything was kind of cool. I will also say that as far as from a production standpoint, as far as the what the actors went through for their duality of roles, I really enjoyed it, because there was some subtlety to some changes they made between their Earth 1 and Earth 2 counterpart. I'm just going to use that.
There were some also not so subtle changes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that they did, like, I guess this is why it's classic, but, you know, if you need to show that a guy is evil, you give him a face scar. If you need to show that a woman is evil, you give her black hair.
But that, all right, so we're going to wonder about that. So I'm going to talk about Alt Liz for a second. Because Liz, at this point, within her run in the seventh season of Classic Who, is really in her prime. She's really got a great stride with Pertwee. You know, really kind of, you know, at this point, the fans and the viewers really understand, you know, where Carolyn John is coming from in her role. And you genuinely enjoy the rapport that they have. Then you meet Alt Liz. And yes, she's a company along the way. The whole Republican security forces, dyed in the wool, kind of very Trump era. I'm sorry, that word didn't really come out right. Type. But by the time you get to the last two episodes and she starts to see the, you know, that the Emperor has no clothes kind of thing, she becomes an equally engaging, really interesting character from a very different slant.
Mm.
And that's what I really enjoyed, is that they found that. Even the brigade leader, who was just a right prick through the entire thing, by the time you see, I think it's like in the closing minutes of the last episode, where he's got none of his men to back him up, and he's like almost whimpering. I mean, that from Courtney, that's a really interesting character choice to show that breakdown of a of a a position of power when there's no actualized power behind it. So I was really entertained by that. I don't know. I mean, I think the only person who was consistently just an asshat was the professor. Put the beard on him at the beginning. Be like, oh, that guy, he's got a Van Dyke beard. He's gonna be a villain.
Dr. Goatee. Yep.
But then they take the beard off him in Alt-Earth.
And he's still
a jerk. He's still a jerk. Now he's just a jerk with a
drill. Drill, baby, drill.
Drill, baby, drill.
But that's a good point, though, is that he was one of those that, like, you knew he was evil no matter which Earth you were on, whereas the one of the things I noticed with the brigade leader versus the brig is that you couldn't help but loathe the brigade leader. Like, the more time went on, the more slimy he felt, and more it just, you couldn't stand him. But then the minute that you get back to proper Earth and you see the brig again, you're like, oh, thank God. Like, it didn't taint his character at all.
I just wouldn't
It was
hug
just
you.
One of those things, like, Yeah,
but you know what? And that's interesting, because when you take that into account, so you've got the two. Oh God, help me out on the expert that they called in. Petra's.
Romantic
interest.
I don't remember his name.
It's gonna bug me. I should have that right top of mind. But
Sutton. It was Sutton.
Sutton. Okay, I was gonna say Stewart. That was a different guy. So Sutton. Yeah. I like the fact that that was a subtle shift between true Sutton, who was just the womanizing, you know, D-bag.
Yeah.
And then you've got alternate Sutton, who was actually a pretty pleasant guy.
Was decent.
Yeah. I don't think they needed to necessarily establish that little bit of a fledgling relationship between the two. I mean, well, I get that they did it, but I don't think they needed to take it quite as far as the, no, let's run from here. Come with me. You're the only reason I need to stay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little bit rushed for that. Let's just, you know, I didn't quite need that much of it, but I like the subtlety and the differences between his character. Petra's character, though, that I enjoyed. Oh, yeah. Her duality was awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the fun ones. I think her and Benton were the two that were the most interesting, just because...
Your gorilla.
I mean, because let's face it. Yeah, Benton basically just lost reasonable thought. That's all it was. It's like, he takes orders in both versions of him, but in Alt-Earth, or Earth 2, or whatever we're calling it, you know, he's just, that's all he does. He doesn't think. He's straight company man. Like, he said do this, that's what I'm doing, and that's it. And he's a thug.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
He's a thug that just found the right job.
Yeah. Which is why I love when you get around to about episode 6. So you're seeing everything that's going on in Alt-Earth, and the brigade leader is just being the right dick that he is. And then all of a sudden, they do the spinning disco ball back to Earth 1. You did notice that was a spinning disco ball, by the way. Bring it back to true Earth. And there's the brig who is dressing down Benton. Bring me the professor. Well, he doesn't want to come. He calls you a pompous idiot and whatever. And the brig just basically tells him to man up, you know, earn your stripes, Sergeant Benton.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you get to see the great aspect of Benton 1 versus Benton 2. And John Levine really starting to flesh out that character in such an enjoyable way. And that was actually the same episode where I realized, because that's when the duality of characters really starts to stand out, that Alt Liz, when she gets really provoked, is not to be trifled with. Because, she starts really laying down the law to everyone. But I also realized that fire extinguishers have never had such good PR in their entire existence. These things are the super weapon of the future. I'm gonna put one in every room of my house.
For a super hot werewolf.
Well, I had to explain, because I was taking Julie through this for the first time. And she's watching it. She's like, she's really enjoying it too. And she's like, why is it every time they go to take down one of the zombie werewolves? I'm sorry, zombie Earth Core werewolves.
I called them Hulk Kongs.
All right, Hulk. Yeah, all right, the Hulk Kongs. That they aim the fire extinguisher at their crotch. My first reaction was, I know that would take me down. Second reaction was the more practical. Well, you don't want to aim a fire extinguisher at an actor's face.
Right.
So play towards, they were probably told to play towards the chest, but they were erring on the side of caution.
Yeah.
And said, I'll just aim down here.
You know that the cancer-causing glue and makeup is already causing problems.
Right.
Right. You don't want to suffocate them on top of it.
What could possibly go wrong? But man, but all right, so here, when we get to some of the listener contributions on this one, they bring up some excellent points that I had down repeatedly through my notes, and that had to do with the fact that this was a story of firsts. Our friend who we really got to know really well at Elihu, Jeremy Raddick, you know from the 96 film, Clang, name drop, sorry, tweeted back to us and said that he considers this to be what would be his favorite classic story. It's a perfect example of what he considers to be what made season 7 unique and bold. Now, to build on that, we've had some listeners who got back to us on Facebook and kind of quantified that, and it really had to do with this multiverse theory. And this is something, I mean, if you do the research on it, this is the first story where the idea of multiple universes or parallel dimensions was really called out per se. You know, you deal with things like the Celestial Toy Maker or stories like that where there was an alternate dimension, as they called it, but it really wasn't necessarily tied to what we know now as the idea of the multiverse. You know, each decision that you make causes the split, and then there's, you know, A and B, and then another decision is made, and A, B, and C, and on and on and on. They tell two friends, and they tell two friends, and so on mm-hmm. and so on. So this, Chris from who we know from the Regen Who crowd said that this is a groundbreaker because the introduction of a multiverse means, and I give him so much credit for bringing this up, that time can and does get changed on a regular basis. So here's where the gloves come off as far as a time traveler who realizes that the future is not cast in stone.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and that one of the things that, I mean, this kind of ties into this is, you know, we were talking about it a little bit. When you look at the characters versus their alt versions, you can see where they spawn from the same core person. Like, you can see elements of the Brig and the Brigadier Leader. You can see where, you know, it's a lot of bad choices or something like that that led him to that point. You know, same with most of the other characters, where it's like each one of them is, you know, they can come from. And so that's a great point in this, where every choice that you make spawns a new thing. And so, yeah, it's absolutely fits into that.
Yeah.
Well, a big core part of who the Brig is he serves Queen and Country. And what happens if you take those things away?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, just a warning to all of you behind the Republican security forces.
I also thought the Doctor got pretty cavalier with, you know, writing off this universe rather quickly.
True. I kind of thought about that for a little while. The fact that he recognized that it was well beyond a point of no return. Mm. I mean, that's a pretty big deal to say, not only, and then to make the decision that I cannot save a single one of you.
Well, and that's one of those things too, is like it seems like this is the first time that the Doctor has ever encountered a parallel universe. Like, he's used to traveling through time and what that entails, but this is the first time that he's ever said, okay, no, this is an alternate dimension. I have no idea what's going to happen if I bring one of you back, because that's not a time paradox, that's a reality paradox, and I haven't messed with that yet. I don't know how far I can push that envelope. So I think that's a lot of where his conviction came from, about he can't save any of them.
Yeah. No, and that was true. He actually, and you could tell from the way that he was reacting to it, he was referring to the fact that he had slipped sideways, as he referred to it, into a parallel world, and it was taking him entirely by surprise. He had no idea that was even capable. And that actually ties in really well to one of the comments that we had gotten from Ian. He had said that the dropping this whole multiverse theory in was a huge groundbreaker, not only for for the show itself, but in a lot of respects as far as science fiction television for the time. But the fact that the TARDIS was capable of it is another matter entirely. So the fact that given, you know, a poor set of controls and the right power source, you could actually slip the thing sideways within your dimensional plane. I think it's kind of interesting that this was all done, you know, this tinkering with the TARDIS console outside of the TARDIS proper, and with the console as the true mechanism behind the craft of the TARDIS, will get explained further as the series continues. But you're dealing with something where I think even within this story, by the time the story concludes, even the Brig is aware of the fact that the Doctor is trying to play outside the rules. Yeah. And doesn't quite condemn him for it. He just kind of shakes his head and says, you know, I'm gonna punch his pilot this thing and just back away. But I think it sets up a very interesting dynamic for what the third Doctor is attempting to do. It keeps us cognizant of the fact that he feels trapped. As much as he enjoys the company of his Earthling cohorts, he does not genuinely want to be here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that is a good point. Like, that's one of those things that I love that they started doing with this, with Series 7, or Season 7, mm-hmm. is that they really do build the story over the course of the season. It's not like it was in Troughton's era where, yeah, you'd get a reference to stuff that happened before or whatever, but each story was its own individual thing that fit where it fit, and that was it. Whereas this, each story is its own thing, but you can tell where it fits into a larger, persistent world.
Yeah. So, progression.
I mean, we've seen the evolution of the Doctor and the Briggs friendship just over the course of this season.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And there's even allusions to it towards the close of this story, where you can tell that their trust factor has been shaken, but they're trying to hold it together, you know, and the Doctor mm-hmm. leaves in a huff. Goes and transmats out of there, but he only moves a couple seconds in the future and about 100 yards to the left and then the top of a rubbish tip.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of sums up their relationship right now, which I know calls to Haley because, hey, continuity.
I know. What is this?
It's a whole new era in Doctor Who.
That was spectacular. Him walking in and looking totally disheveled, and you're like, what grand adventure did he go on since we last saw him? he went on a trip to the garbage bin. That might be the cleverest thing they've done so far in the series.
It is. I love the fact that this story closes on such a kind of a happy note. There's that little goofery. There's the little joking with Liz, and everything's on a great point. And it's something that both Heather and Ian both commented to us on Facebook about, the fact that it's kind of bittersweet that the fact that this is Haley, sorry, hate to break it to you, this is Liz's last story.
Ah!
Yeah, we don't get a proper send-off. It's kind of odd that way. And we'll let you deal with that when we finally get around to Terror of the Autons in about 2 weeks from now. But yeah, it's definitely bittersweet, to say the least. So, but I'm glad that it's able to go out for Catherine John on such a high note, because it's genuinely enjoyable. It is definitely a heartwarming close to what is a pretty dramatic, pretty serious story at the heart of it all, as far as their relationships and as far as dealing with with the destruction or the collapse of an entire dimension. Again, that the Doctor just has to deal with the fact that he has to walk away from that. So
I would have to wonder, was that typical of the classic companions? Did they often not get a real send off?
In a lot of instances, yeah. They
I kind of figured
they either had to get some sort of a creative write off, or it had to be done through clip sequences or something of that sort to explain their departure. I would say that is maybe not a majority of the time, but a recognizable amount of the time.
Yeah.
There had to be some sort of a creative way of seeing them off.
Well, yeah. And I'd imagine it's, you know, at the time contract negotiations were done in the off season, and if, you know, they didn't negotiate a new contract, that actor was not coming back. So
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, just off the top of my head, the ones I can think of, Dodo, Tegan, yep. Perry. I mean, all of them are basically just like, and out the door. What?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you didn't get, I'm sure there are more, but those are the only ones I can think of right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So that's kind of a, well, so as you can tell, Haley, just to let you know, I mean, as what Jay's just alluding to, it's not going to get corrected anytime soon.
Okay. Don't get too attached to anybody.
Exactly. They can
pretty much. It's like Game of Thrones.
Yeah. You've paid for the entire seat, but you'll only need the edge.
Just never pick a favorite. You'll be better that way.
Not at all. Unless it's Fraser Hines. Always bet on Fraser Hines. All right, so I have an idea that I want to throw at you for the next segment. So you ready?
Ready.
Okay.
All right, let's go with it.
Ladies and gentlemen, prepare yourselves a clean sheet of paper, lined if you need, doesn't matter, and grab yourself a marker. Form yourself a standard tic-tac-toe grid and box it in so that you have a 3x3 grid there. All right. This is fascinating for the listeners at home. Okay, I got visual aid here from Jay. Okay, confirmation. Haley is still drawing because she's an engineer and she's not good at straight lines.
She's got out the T-square.
Oh my gosh, you got a T-square. Oh, Jesus Christ. There's a freaking protractor involved. Okay,
Haley, good. Put down the slide rule.
Oh, well, that's even better than Jay's. I'll let that go then. All right. So essentially, what I'm going to want you to do is I'm going to want you to play a little game that we're going to call Galley 1 Social Media Bingo. It's a simple game. The rules are as such. You're going to fill in each square with something that you would expect to see as a result of a tweet or a Facebook post or some sort of a Tumblr post or something where somebody who is at Galley 1 this coming weekend as we approach the upcoming event on from the 17th to the 19th of February, this year of our Loward 2017, something you expect to see depicted in visual format.
Okay.
Not something that someone said, oh, OMG, I just saw Lala Ward stealing someone's gin and tonic. No, I don't want a text referral to it. I want visual confirmation. I want pictures. So if you see a posted picture, so each one of your 9 squares, you're going to fill in something that you expect to see pictured from this coming convention weekend. All right.
Okay.
Now, we can decide right now, just among the three of us, whether or not we want the middle square to be a free space, which is something like something is just a given. Like
a Dalek?
Okay, yeah. A practical Dalek somewhere in the corridors of the Marriott.
Okay.
All right.
So we'll make the middle square a practical Dalek.
All right.
Now, the other 8 squares, I'm going to let you all fill them in. We will protect all of our listeners from the couple of minutes it takes for this to get done through creative editing happening right about now.
Bung.
Please tell me you're going to fill it in with, like, the J-Bob send-off music.
If I could find the sax solo, I probably would.
All right.
Somebody's got to have it somewhere.
So are we all going to have the same things on here and just in different places, or do we each make our own car?
Make your
completely?
Own.
Okay.
Okay. So here's, I'll kind of set you up with my grid here, just so that you get an idea. These are all legit, and I'm not going to take like screen caps or anything of this, but my grid is completed. So Jay and Haley can attest to this here. That's done. Mm-hmm. So going from top left here across. So my first square, Nicholas Briggs doing something odd or unusual with a prop. It could be a fan prop. It could be something that he brought on his own and just decides to be unusual with it. So be it. Second square, baby cosplay. I have always held Galley as being one of these occurrences where I see little ones cosplayed to a near professional level, and I expect nothing less. Top right square, Chase Masterson hugging someone. It happens.
So a free square.
Pretty much. Pretty much. Yeah. Middle left, drunk talent.
Oh, jeez. Another free square.
Exactly. But I thought of it. So it's there. But I don't know that Paul Salamoff is actually going to be the convention this year. So I can't take that as a given. Sorry, Paul. Middle square, practical Dalek. Middle right, Paul McGann holding up a weird toy. Lately, people have been handing him strange. He gets depicted holding up unusual either little figurines of himself or some other strange thing. So I'm going with Paul McGann holding up a weird proper toy. Bottom left, Louise Jameson alongside a Leela cosplayer. So Leela with Leela. And bottom row center, Paul Cornell really excited about something. Haley knows this one very well. Knows how excited Paul gets about stuff. It's probably a comic discussion. And my bottom right, because we love her to death, Daphne Ashbrook in a scarf.
Okay.
There you go. All right. That's my grid.
Okay. I suppose that I will go next. So in the same order that Keir went, top left corner, someone who is too heavyset to be cosplaying the 10th Doctor.
Okay.
Nick Briggs doing something with the ring modulator.
Oh, okay. Depicted in visual format? Okay, I guess it'll all depend on the caption.
Well, somebody's going to take a picture of him with the ring modulator at a panel. You know it's going to happen.
Okay.
Let's see. Fraser Hines and a Jamie cosplayer.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
All right. Then we move on to the middle row. We've got a Davros cosplayer.
Okay, cool. Easy.
Then we have the practical Dalek.
Yep.
And then I decided to go a little more specific on your baby cosplay, and I'm going to say Dalek stroller.
Okay, yeah. We've been seeing those specifically at Galley. It might be the same family that shows up and just keeps upping their game every year. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And then bottom left corner, a Bill cosplayer.
Oh, okay. Just cool. Good call.
And then then we have a couple fun ones here. Daphne Ashbrook, drink in hand.
No comment.
All right. And then my final square is Catherine Stewart being sexy AF.
So
you can just mark that one now?
Picture exactly. Of Catherine. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right. Go for it, Haley.
All right. Talent wearing the cone of shame.
Oh, so you're assuming that they're going to have the match game of Rassilon.
I would assume. I don't think you're allowed to do a Doctor Who convention without doing that.
I don't know. I got to check and see whether our good friends are going to be there.
Is anybody going to Galley this year? Good grief.
Well, I would assume that since it's his hometown, yeah.
That he would be there.
That our beloved Josh Friedman would be running the extremely loud and profane match game of Rassilon. Okay.
All right. Well, the theme of this year is 28 years later. Mm-hmm. So I think there might be some Zombie Who crossover cosplay. That's my... I'm not sure that one's going to happen, but I had to put it on the card.
All right.
I think we're going to see at least one picture of Missy and Osgood cosplaying together.
Okay. Has to be specifically together.
Yes.
Okay.
Paul McGann in a hat and scarf.
Hat?
Yeah. He usually comes on stage wearing a hat and then takes it off, doesn't he?
Oh, scarf, yes.
Oh, we'll see then.
Okay.
I might not do very well, guys. Dalek.
Yep.
A cosplay group of 4+ doctors.
Okay.
Okay, yeah.
A small child in a canine.
Okay.
Daphne Ashbrook in the lobby bar.
I'm noticing a trend.
I'm detecting a theme.
I'm so sorry, Daphne. I love you, baby. I'm sorry.
And Chase Masterson in her PJs.
Oh, yes, that's true. Because last year she arrived in her bathrobe in the middle of the match game and drew everyone's attention for about 20 minutes straight. Okay, noted.
All right. That's it.
So the game is on. And just to let everyone know, the prize on this one, which doesn't mean a whole lot to you right now, but it's going to mean a hell of a lot to us in a few weeks, is when we get around to our 96 televised movie rewatch, the first one to successfully complete a row vertically, horizontally, or diagonally will win a 30-minute reprieve to be able to get out of drinking during the film rewatch. So we'll be playing the drinking game, and you will be able to put your drink down and actually get some water and avoid hospitalization for up to 30 minutes during.
And I had suggested this might not actually be a prize. The alcohol might be necessary.
I will say that, based on the criteria of how most of the drinking games are surrounding this film work, you will want a 30-minute reprieve to avoid liver failure.
And see, I was thinking about it. Like, you could technically do this strategically and pick the 30 minutes that you know are going to be the most heavily drink-laden.
Yes.
But in order to do that, you might actually have to watch the movie in preparation, and therefore you don't actually win at all.
I will set you up to know that that Eric Roberts appears roughly 16 minutes into the film. There you go. Anyway, so that's our game for this week, and you'll get the payoff in the near future. Well, obviously, when we track our winners after all of the various social media posts come about for all of you who are attending Galley 1, we are so sorry that we will not be there with you, but we are going to live vicariously through you. So if you want to help us out, any of us in the game to follow?
Hint.
Keep your smartphone cameras at the ready and, help a brother out here.
If you could tweet at Awesome Engineering Girl, AwesomeEngrGRL, when you see something.
Or just send it all to at Gallifrey Radio, and we'll file it, fairly, honestly. You won't even believe how fair we could be. So fair. The fairest.
The fairest of them all.
Bigly fair.
It's going to be huge.
All right.
On to the news.
Let's go into the news.
News!
All right. So obviously one of the big stories surrounding the Hooniverse right now is the fact that Peter Capaldi will be leaving at the end of Series 10. And there's an article here actually, and it's not even a Doctor Who-centric article. It's the 2017 Hot List, and it's just a bunch of different British young actors and questions about them. So one of the actors that they focused on was Pearl Mackie, mm-hmm. and through the course of the questions, they started asking her questions about Doctor Who, obviously, and they asked, how do you feel about Peter leaving? And she just goes on to say that she's sad, but she's really happy that she got the chance to work with him, and he's a generous actor, and so just nothing but praise for him. Mm-hmm. But I can't imagine that this comes as anything but a blow to someone that's just joining the show.
Right. Well, you got to figure somebody who's at the first real pivotal upswing. And granted, I mean, as far as the work that she has done prior to this point, she's already established herself fondly within a lot of the British viewing audience for her work within. Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which personally, I mean, I'm a considerable fan of the stage production, but as far as screen work, if her only experience up to this point has been with the soap opera Doctors on BBC, she hasn't even got her EastEnders cred yet. Who can imagine? How did she get this gig anyway? But to be able to glean as much as she can off of Capaldi's experience is something that I would think that, as brief as it may be over the course of these 12 episodes, you gather as much as you possibly can, and appreciate it for all that it's worth. I'm not in the least bit surprised that the nature of her comments have to do with the fact that he not only showed a respect for her as a peer, regardless of where she is within the scope of her career, she is a fellow actor and she warrants that degree of respect. But at the same time, it's a matter of kind of conveying a lot of the the basic advice you would give to anyone who's coming into a particular production and says, okay, you know, watch out for on this technical aspect. Okay, this, you know, these cameras tend to, you know, close in from this side. You want to make sure that you're, you know, you're blocking faces you this way, you know, and kind of doing all of these things from an aspect of specifically camera-based acting. So that's, mm-hmm. you know, I would absolutely expect that from a consummate professional like Cabaldi.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not to mention, in the same interview, her go-to karaoke song, Don't Stop Believin'. Come on. And a gin and tonic with yep. a slice of cucumber. I love this woman. I love her to death right now.
Don't Stop Believin'. What an original choice for karaoke. Couldn't help it.
Literally.
All right. Well, and then, lots of people are speculating about who the next Doctor is going to be, including the Doctor. David Tennant has come out and had a theory about, you know, who the next Doctor or what the next Doctor is going to be. Mm. Not necessarily who the actor is going to be, but the kind of person we're going to see.
Yeah. And I think that's really indicative of what's been sort of teeing up lately. And Capaldi has been a real personification of this. So Tennant's theory, obviously, being a consummate Doctor Who fan himself prior to his casting within the role, now being married to a semi-Time Lord, being the son-in-law of a Time Lord, I guess he can kind of speak to this with a certain degree of, you know, reckless aplomb.
He might have a slight bit of, yeah.
Yeah. So, but his whole point is that you really have to know the program. You have to know the legacy. You have to be a fan of it to really capture everything that the titular role entails and calls for. And I think that's probably very valid. Is it a deal breaker?
No.
No, but it's probably, you know, as far as, you know, everything that Chris Chibnall has said, as far as his sitting back and saying, all right, I've got a hell of a daunting task ahead of me trying to identify the next Doctor, and he hasn't really tipped his hands as far as what he's using as his determining criteria, but you've got to imagine that somebody who comes into it with a great working knowledge of the legacy of the program is going to be at a considerable advantage over someone who's coming in on a real cold read. So,
mm-hmm. Well, and just look at the past two Doctors that we've had. And dear God, I know I'm going to catch some grief for this, and I'm sorry in advance for bringing up the comparison. But I mean, you look at Matt Smith, who is someone that knew very little about Doctor Who when he came into the role, and I mean, arguably he did a great job with it. But it was something he had to grow into, and we grew alongside him. Mm-hmm. Versus Capaldi, who came into it knowing everything before he even got there.
Yeah.
And it was just, it's stepping into a familiar pair of shoes for him. It's not something that he had to grow into.
No, not in the least. He came out swinging hard, and it was obvious from the early episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people. It's got
to
be a lot easier to play a character if you know everything about that character going in.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people that consider Smith their Doctor, and I can't fault them for that. You know, he really did form the role around him towards the end. Like, it was something that he really did get a feel for, but it wasn't something that he hit hard like Capaldi did.
Yeah, yep. So. I couldn't agree more. So whether or not that really ends up bearing on the casting decision that's going to come down... God, I would assume it's going to be at least 3-4 months before we even have a hint at who's on the shortlist.
Yeah, at least.
Yeah, definitely after the season finale.
Yeah. So, but we'll continue to, you know, wildly hypothesize and so forth. But this has to be a pretty strong feather in the cap of anyone who is sitting down to a screen test. So, yeah. Yeah, wouldn't be surprised. So as you hear all these crackpot theories from all the British tabloids about who's saying, oh, well, I'd absolutely love the opportunity to be given the role, and they run off with the headlines, find out how much they actually know about the series first. I know all about Dr. What? Dr. When?
Inspector Spacetime.
Yeah. Inspector Spacetime.
So unfortunately, the sad news that... So we're losing doctors... We're losing Moffat as the showrunner. Apparently, we're also going to be losing Moffat as a writer for Doctor Who. Yeah.
Yeah, we had theorized about this before. We had wondered whether he may consider staying on either as a collaborative writer, because we know there's the discussion about the writer's room format that that Chibnall will be instituting, more of a sort of a U.S. format. But by the same token, I mean Moffat is an exceptional writer. Say what you will about him. I mean, when he puts pen to paper and starts to put together something that shows how well he, you know, speaking of super fans of the program, is really knows how to pull all of the right strings and push all the right buttons from a fan base perspective to really get the best reaction from the storyline. So was he planning on staying on to a certain regard, or even assisting other fledgling writers in their first foray into it? And apparently he's going to take the RTD route and completely distance himself from it for a little while, for good reason, I feel.
I can especially see that for Chibnall's first season. Let Chibnall define the tone of his show, and then maybe in later seasons coming in and writing an episode that fits the new show.
Yeah, I really hope that is the case. Like, I hope it's one of those things. And he may very well mean that he's going to step away and he doesn't plan to come back. But I really hope that something happens in the future that, you know, Chibnall might be able to get a hold of him and be like, hey, how about just a one-off? You know, come back, do about, you know, do one.
Have him write under a pseudonym. That'd be awesome.
Oh, jeez.
Marvin Stoffit. Marvin Stoffit, the unheard-of writer. Yeah. I'm gonna go secure that Twitter handle right now. Marvin.
No, what's the name that Douglas Adam used?
Oh crap.
I was trying to think of that. I can't.
Oh my god. That's gonna bother me now that I don't know that right off the top. No. Of damn it. I'm too tired and slightly inebriated. More tired than inebriated. I should reverse those. Anyway.
Oh man.
But yeah, so does that mean that by the time we get around to series 12, 13, maybe he'll tip his hand back in? I think he actually implied within the article that that's a possibility, but he genuinely respects, now in retrospect, he genuinely respects Russell's decision to let the next crew run with it on their own merit and really establish their own iteration of the program. And he feels that it did him the best service, so he wishes only the same for Chris and company going forward. And I can't challenge that in the least.
David Agnew.
I was getting ready to say that.
Agnew. Damn it.
I win. Ah. Sorry, Kira was being all like, yo, poetic and deep and stuff.
And we were racing to say David Agnew. Feeling things.
My emotions. My emotions.
All right. Well, that's all the news that we've got for this week. Next week, since we just finished off our watch of Class, we decided that it would be kind of interesting to take a look at the spinoff series that we've gotten so far and kind of compare and contrast. And one of the ways that we're going to do this is actually, each one of us is going to take a spinoff and champion that as the ultimate spinoff of Doctor Who. And we'll praise the things that they did right. We will bash the things that the other ones did wrong. And we'll see who comes out on top.
Okay. So just to let you know, so that you can jump to our personal defense over the week to follow, Jay will be taking Torchwood. Haley will be defending Class as the new upstart punk kid.
It's what the kids are doing these days.
And I will be holding the banner high for old school and the Sarah Jane Adventures. God damn it.
So Jay will be acting like the adult. Haley is the young upstart, and Kier is the overgrown child.
Yes, with a really bad CGI. Yeah. That'll be me. Poor special effects, so it makes perfect but sense. A lot of heart.
How did an adult get on this podcast?
Grandfather Day.
All right. Well, this has been episode 220 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, yes, well, I think there's something that you should be that should be of vital interest to you, Professor, that you, sir, are a nitwit.
And this is Kier saying, what do you expect? Some kind of space rocket with Batman at the controls?
And this is Haley saying, Venusian Karate versus Evil Flubber from the Center of the Earth. In theaters now.
We'll see you guys next week.
Allons-y.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community. I will likely have the kids that weekend, but...
Oh, you think?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, because I'm not going to...
You can't be drunk, well, responsible dad.
I can... Mikey's responsible enough. The kids will be passed out anyway.
Hey, you know... this, what you gotta do, Morty. Stop calling me Morty, Dad.
Oh, they're used to being called Morty anyway.
You realize the name that we used to tell people when they're like, oh, have you picked out names yet? Mortimer. And they'd go kind of blank for a second. They're like, well, what if it's a girl? Same. What? It's nice. You can't tell. Are you trying to gender associate my child? look at Haley having an idea.
She helps.
She's evolving.
I'm going to mark that in my calendar while I'm in here.
Haley came up with an idea.
Haley did a thing. Haley did a thing.
I can adult.
Shut your faces. I come up with ideas sometimes.
I contribute. What's more, we find that it's a bad idea, even if... That's not those words. What's more, we find that a bad idea...
Come on, you're making my editing even harder. Stop talking.